stay tuned. You're listening to the Weekend Interview Show here on Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas.
The evolution of ideas.
I'll tell you how this works. For instance, why is the drug czar of this country, why do we have a drug czar, A? B, why is he a cop? Why isn't he a guy who's been through recovery, who has experienced drug and alcohol addiction, and could perhaps deal with this problem through the eyes of compassion rather than the eyes of, whatever their eyes are, that you're breaking a law. People who are addicts are not criminals. In my mind's eye, they're sick. And I don't think throwing sick people in jail is going to heal them. See, that would be the evolution of an idea.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Philip Drew, Administrator. And our guest today is James P. Gray. He is a judge of the Superior Court in Orange County, California, a former federal prosecutor, and is a libertarian candidate for the United States Senate seat in California. He is the author of the book Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It, a judicial indictment of the war on drugs. Welcome to the show, sir.
Philip, it's nice to be with you. Always nice to touch base with people from Texas.
All right. Well, honored to have you here today, Your Honor. Why do you hold such opposition to the drug wars?
Well, if anyone sat in my seat, Philip, I'm a former federal prosecutor, as you said. Before that, I was a military defense attorney, criminal defense attorney in Navy JAG, and now a trial judge for 20 years. It's really clear that all we're doing is churning low offenders through the system for no good purpose whatsoever. And then if you get into it more closely, you'll see the police putting our own children in harm's way, not because of the drugs so much, but because of the drug money, that the kids are corrupted by going out and seeing that they can make lots of easy money in the drug market, so they go out and sell drugs. And I ask you, if you have a 15, 16-year-old out in the community selling drugs, who do they sell to? You and me? No, they sell to their 14, 15, 16-year-old peers, thus, in fact, recruiting more children into a life of drug usage and drug selling. The United States of America leads the world in the incarceration of its people, both per capita as well as sheer numbers. And I got to tell you, here, we're number one does not make me proud, and besides, it's enormously expensive. So what I'm doing is I have left the bench on an unpaid leave of absence for a year, actually, and I'm running for the United States Senate, and every vote I get will legitimately be seen as a vote in favor of getting the federal government out of the marijuana prohibition business. And believe me, it's truly a big business. They're making huge amounts of money on it. But every 45 seconds, someone in the United States of America is arrested for a marijuana offense. Here in California, we have three times more people incarcerated on what we call a three strikes sentence of 25 years to life, mandatory sentencing. Three times more for marijuana violations than for robbery, rape, and murder combined. It's supposed to have taken violent offenders off the streets, and it's doing anything but. And so it's simply something that we have to talk about. So I talk about it as much as I can.
In your Senate race, what kind of numbers do you have so far, percentage of votes-wise in the polls?
Well, we haven't polled. I can tell you, though, that I was just a couple of days ago up in Mendocino County, which is kind of the mid-northern area of California, and my campaign was endorsed by the district attorney of Mendocino County as well as the sheriff of Mendocino County.
Oh, you don't say.
Well, in fact, that's right, and they were elected, in effect, to make marijuana the lowest of priority with regard to prosecutions. They do that, and the message we were giving to the press and it was received is, look, to the federal government, our local officials have the situation in hand. They're doing what the people want, just telling the federal government to leave us alone. And I think that message is being heard.
Yeah, I noticed in the book you have a section called Federalism, Not Federalization. And I thought, wow, you know, you might be the first man to run for the United States Senate in 25 years who even knows the difference.
Yeah, you know, I've been a lifelong Republican all my life until about a year and a half ago, but our great country was founded upon the concept of federalism. That is to say, in effect, now we have 50 crucibles of democracy. Let's let each state decide what is best for its people, and then some will work and some won't. So obviously we would gravitate over toward what works. Federalization is what we have been doing, namely every administration, every president in my lifetime has left office with a larger, more expensive federal government than when he took office. That certainly includes our present president. The government is 16% larger than it was when George W. Bush took office. So this is something that simply must stop. The bureaucracy is continuing to grow. Literally, Philip, every federal agency we have now gets extra money to fight the war on drugs, and that's not just the obvious ones like the Department of State or Department of Justice or all of the military. It's really the little ones, too. It's the Department of Agriculture and Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Agriculture. Each one gets additional funds expressly earmarked in its budget to fight the war on drugs. And as two sitting congressmen have told me, people in Washington know that the war on drugs is not winnable, but it's eminently fundable. And each agency is addicted to that drug funding. And that's the problem. There's just too much money in it.
I'm pretty young, but I think even when I was a boy, the idea of the national government funding the local police departments would have been something abhorrent to basic American principles, that we would make our local police dependent on the national government.
I think that that is a fear that is being realized now. But, you know, the federal government, just by threatening to take away highway funds, for example, can have its way with regard to lots of things, education, health, and certainly with regard to drugs. And people are just so reliant now upon the federal government, and it is bringing us into positions we do not want to be. One of them, the so-called Patriot Act, this is a direct frontal assault upon our civil liberties that is unnecessary for our security and our safety, but is deeply intrusive into our civil liberties and taking us a long way down the road to a police state. That's another thing that I'm trying to spread the alarm on. And, of course, the war on drugs has resulted in more of our loss of civil liberties, really, than anything in the history of our country. So these are things that we as citizens owe it to our children and our grandchildren to stand up and say, no, this is not where we're going to go as free society.
So if you are elected to the Senate, your first order of business will be to try to get the Patriot Act repealed then?
What I call the excesses of the Patriot Act, there are several things in there that I think are just fine under today's circumstances. And those would include the allowing of our various federal agencies to share information, terrorist information, among themselves. For a while, at least we thought that the CIA could not share information with the FBI or vice versa. I don't think that that was a real fear or honest one, but that was what people thought, and the Patriot Act was meant to address that. And I think that's fine. But anything that allows the federal police to simply call this a Philip Drew terrorist investigation, and all they have to do is that administratively, and then they can go into your house, they can go into your personal effects, your computer, your banks, your car dealership, your insurance agency, all of these different things, take whatever information they deem to be appropriate without even telling you, and all without a judicially improved warrant. That's the difference. Now, of course, they could do that pretty much, but they'd have to have probable cause and go to a judicial officer. If they label it a terrorist investigation, they do not have to do that. And that, to me, is really a scary thing.
And it used to be all they had to deal with was the FISA court, which I believe the only time they ever denied a warrant, it was to tap John Wong's phone. But other than that, they give the FBI any warrant they want.
Well, of course, just by having the protections there, Philip, certainly have a screening process in themselves, that if they know that they're going to be reviewed, then they do it right, and that's the whole idea. So just because that may be the case, and I've heard that too, but I don't know, but assuming it would be true, just by knowing that there's a judicial officer there, that would force them to do it right for fear of having it rejected.
Oh, absolutely. Well, don't get me wrong. Like, I mean, well, it was already that bad anyway, so who cares? I was thinking more like they have no excuse because the FISA court will give them any warrant they want and always have.
Well, I have given warrants before as a judge in the Superior Court here in Orange County. And, you know, you want the right thing to happen, but numbers of times I have handed it back to them and said, wait a minute, you know, you don't have any information on this or on that. Go back and get me some more information. So they do, and eventually then I'd have signed it. I don't think I have ever, I think I might have declined one in my 20 years of as a judge. But, you know, you work with them and say that, no, I need more information here on the declaration, and I won't sign it until I get it. So that's a protection that we all need. Nazi Germany didn't have that, neither did the Soviet Union. I don't think Fidel Castro is doing that very much either. But we in the United States are going in that particular direction. If I were to write an article about this, Philip, the title of the article would be, Where's Paul Revere? Why is no one spreading the alarm? It's so easy to give up our civil liberties to the government and almost impossible to get them back. So these are extremely important elections coming up. That's why I've taken an unpaid leave of absence for a year as a judge of the Superior Court here in Orange County to run as a libertarian for the U.S. Senate. And I request, I know that you're in Texas and you have other listeners as well, but everyone knows someone who works, lives, and votes in California. And if you will contact me through my website, give me your email address, we will send your listeners information, and they can forward them on to other people that they know that work and live and vote in California, and spread the word that every vote counts. Don't vote for the lesser of two evils between the Republicans and Democrats. Vote for Judge Kim Gray for U.S. Senate and have your vote count. Every vote will be seen legitimately as a vote in favor of getting the federal government out of marijuana prohibition and repealing the excesses of the Patriot Act.
I'm Philip Drew, and I have on the phone Judge James P. Gray, Superior Court judge from California, who's running for Senate as a libertarian. You know, something you brought up there made me question. You seem to have such strong principles about what liberty is supposed to be about. I wonder how often upholding the law conflicts with your own personal beliefs and how you deal with that when you have to sentence somebody to their mandatory minimum sentence for possession of pot. How do you deal with that situation?
Well, Philip, it is my obligation, my sworn duty to uphold the law. And I do it. In fact, I order my juries as well that if you have a disagreement with the law, you have numbers of options. You can run for Congress or support somebody that is running or move to change the law, but one alternative you do not have is not to enforce it. And I have enforced various things that I didn't feel were appropriate, but that doesn't mean I have to do it quietly. I had some very traumatic experiences because of the drug laws, but unless I can distinguish away from it, I've got to follow the law. And if we don't, we have an anarchy. And in fact, it's hard to swallow this one, but it's true. The best way of getting rid of a bad law is to enforce it. And that way people will see that it's inappropriate and then hopefully change it.
Ooh, ouch. Yeah, that's bordering on the ends justify the means kind of scenario there. I don't know.
No.
I mean, that's what they say about the draft, that if we draft all the rich white kids, then we won't have so many wars. But it's still slavery.
Well, okay, that's something else, too. I personally do not believe that the draft will come back. I know that people are talking about it, but I think at this day and age it's just not going to fly. But we, Philip, I know it's hard, but we have to be a nation of laws. If I were to be allowed to only enforce those laws that I really felt were appropriate, maybe the way I feel is different than you, is different than your uncle, you get a mishmash of things that nobody knows what to expect. So we have to be a nation of laws. Hopefully they'll be reasonable ones. I happen to believe that it was a really good thing when we finally turned away from the 55-mile-an-hour maximum speed limit and put it back up to 65 or where it is because it was so widely disregarded. And that's not good for a society to have laws and then thumb their nose at them. So that was one that was widely disregarded, and then fortunately we moved away from it. It's pretty much the same thing with marijuana. Today in California it's been decriminalized in a lot of ways such that if you possess an ounce it's only a citation of up to a $100 fine. That is a lot different than it used to be. In fact, I think Texas was one of the last states to have it still be a felony just for possession of any amount of marijuana. But that has changed, unfortunately, not because people finally realized that prohibitions don't work. It was changed basically because we were flooded with so many cases because the criminal justice system couldn't handle them. But the same thing is happening now. So I will recommend to the state of California and the state of Texas and the rest, when we finally come to our senses and repeal drug prohibition, that they treat marijuana like alcohol. And I can tell you and your listeners, in my view, there would be seven things that would happen immediately if, in fact, California or Texas or wherever would treat marijuana like alcohol. And the first is, in California, we could save our taxpayers here alone about $1 billion a year that we now spend to try to eradicate marijuana and prosecute and incarcerate nonviolent marijuana offenders. And in California, even though it is illegal, marijuana is our largest cash crop, so obviously we're not keeping it out anyway, so we could save that $1 billion. Number two, we could generate income of about $1.5 billion by, in effect, taxing it, generating that income, So now we have a budget deficit switch of about $2.5 billion that I would think that people would start to appreciate. Number three, in my view, is more important than the first two, and that is that we would make marijuana less available for children than it is today. Why? Because today there are no rules at all, no regulations at all, except those imposed by the drug sellers, and they don't ask for ID. So it's really easier for our young people to get marijuana or really any other drug if they want to than it is a six-pack of beer.
Well, one big problem with that, I think, is that, and I think this is one of the reasons why pot has remained illegal all this time, is that you really can't tax it. Because if it was legal, we wouldn't just go buy a pack of joints made by Marlboro Company at 7-Eleven. We'd grow our own in our closets, and we'd trade them like baseball cards. You know,
well, that may be, and maybe some states would do that, and if so, that would be fine. I think if I were king of California, you know, King James has a kind of a nice ring to it that nobody's ever particularly bought into, but I would not allow that because I don't want it to be available for children, and this way I think that we could keep more control on it. But one way or the other, you know, we could see. Maybe Nebraska would do that, and Illinois would do what I say, and then let's look at it and find out. Doesn't hurt. But just to continue for a minute and finish up, the fourth thing would be the whole hemp industry. And Philip, it just astounds me that big agricultural have not gotten on board on this because hemp is an extremely historically valuable product that you can make all kinds of things from, anything from plywood or 2x4s, or it's a nutritious product to eat. It's a viable, clean-burning gunny sacks used to be made of hemp, canvas, rope, all that sort of thing. So we could revitalize that entire area, and we should. Right now we're importing hemp from those radical countries called Canada and England, and we're really putting ourselves at a disadvantage, and we could simply change that. Five, and I don't know, to be honest with you, what Texas does, but in California we have Proposition 215 about medical marijuana, such that a medical doctor can recommend in writing that their patients use marijuana. If they stay within the guidelines, it's not at all illegal. Well, this would no longer be an issue. If we could get the federal government out of this, that whole problem would go away because them doctors, again, could practice medicine without being intimidated and fearful of the federal police, and that would be an enormously good thing to do. Number six is the quality control issue, that at least under that system you'd know what you were getting. You wouldn't have the mildew or pollutants or whatever, and that would simply be a better situation. So the seventh thing I said would be a question mark. And that is, if we were to treat marijuana like alcohol, would we result in increased usage of marijuana for adults? And in my view, we probably would for at least 6 months, maybe even for 12. Thereafter, we'd probably experience the phenomenon that Holland experienced as they decriminalized marijuana a couple of decades ago. And the Minister of Health of Holland held a press conference and said, you know, in their area they have only half the marijuana usage that we do in our country per capita, both for adults and for teenagers. And went on to explain why. And he said, we have succeeded in making pot boring. And I think that that's a good thing. We in our country glamorize it, make such a profit motive to have people push it on everybody that we simply are paying that price. So these are things that I'm convinced would happen, all of which I believe would be beneficial. And the secret then is to hold people accountable for what they do. And if you or I or any of your listeners drive a motor vehicle while impaired with any of these drugs, certainly including alcohol, that's a crime because it puts others' safety at risk, and that's something that the criminal justice system should step in on. But today, if I were on parole, for example, I could go home and belt down 10 martinis and not be in violation of parole, but if I were to smoke one marijuana cigarette, I could and very likely would be put back in prison for a number of years. I mean, that's just downright stupid, and it's something that we need to look at and change away from.
Let's see if I can segue from drugs into foreign policy with remarks that you made about terrorists selling drugs in order to perpetuate their operations. And I've noticed, call me crazy, but the Taliban had eradicated the poppy plant almost entirely from Afghanistan. And now, in the 3 years since we've taken that place over, their opium crop has gotten bigger and bigger every year and is now at record levels.
Yeah, they lead the world now in selling the opium and heroin. Well, there's a connection. You know, I tell you, we can look at Afghanistan, we can look at Colombia, and we literally could bulldoze the entire country. You take Afghanistan, Colombia, take Peru and Bolivia with it if you want to, and it wouldn't make the slightest bit of difference with regard to our drug problems here. Why? Because it's a matter of simple economics. If the demand is here, the demand will be met. And if it's not met by Afghanistan, Colombia, Peru, or Bolivia, it'll be met by Nigeria or Thailand, or again, even California. So people will take criminal justice risks if they can make large amounts of money for selling small amounts of drugs. So it's just kind of like trying to repeal the law of gravity by repealing the law of supply and demand. It's simply fanciful. It just doesn't work. And look what it's done in Colombia, for example, or Afghanistan. You know, they have corrupted their entire police force, their entire military, with our drug money. I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars every year. And you can corrupt an awful lot of people for that much cash. So those are things that we simply need to realize. We have corrupted the entire safety and life of the folks down in Colombia because of our drug money, and it simply doesn't help. So you're absolutely right. And when it comes down to it, too, the United States of America is awfully arrogant by every year certifying whether any particular country is cooperating enough with regard to our domestic drug problems. Now, that really is an arrogant thing to do. And besides, of course, it's political and fanciful even to get involved in it. It's embarrassing.
I think you point out in one of your articles that this is a reason for a lot of the violent crime on the part of drug dealers and drug users, in fact, as
clearly.
I meant to say here, because the prices are driven up artificially so high that they break into your house and steal your TV in order to get their next fix, whereas
if
it was legal, it would cost pennies on the dollar, right?
All of these drugs, you name it, all of these drugs are dirt cheap. To manufacture, grow, whatever. The only reason they're expensive is because they're illegal. I mean, they don't call marijuana a weed for nothing. It'll grow anywhere. Methamphetamines, you know, you can pretty much, if you know what you're doing, get the various ingredients. You or I could go out in the field someplace or other and spend a weekend, come away with $500,000 worth of methamphetamine, which is, and you can sell out on the street. By the way, it's a very dangerous thing to do. The fumes are toxic. A lot of their children sniff the fumes. Sometimes they blow up. Quality control is difficult, all that goes with it. So we simply are very successful in the criminal justice system in arresting, incarcerating nonviolent, low-level drug offenders. We have filled our prisons with them, leaving this unbelievably lucrative market for people that are better organized, more violent, and smarter, and they appreciate it. And so, yes, there's no question but what alcohol has some problems in our society, and so is tobacco, but at least those drugs are not fueling terrorism. Like the golden goose of terrorism is drug prohibition. That's where most of them get their money. And it's not fueling things like Al Capone. So these are things, again, that we need to recognize and realize. And once we finally repeal drug prohibition, just like when we repealed alcohol prohibition, crime will go down. Homicides went down in the United States of America, entire countrywide, within a year, by 20% when we repealed alcohol prohibition. The same thing's going to happen when we repeal drug prohibition. There's just so much to talk about. The other thing I wanted to say is that it makes as much sense to me to put this gifted actor Robert Downey Jr. in jail for his cocaine problem as it would have Betty Ford in jail for her alcohol problem. Those are medical issues. As long as they don't drive under the influence or create damage or harm or safety problems for others, let doctors address them, not police. And then you won't drive them underground. You won't make them automatic criminals. The doctors can start helping them with their medical problems instead of the police officers putting them in jail, which simply compounds the problems.
Judge Gray, what kind of influence does the so-called prison industrial complex have on the drug laws in this country?
Oh, Philip, it's enormous. In California, the largest, strongest political lobby group is the Prison Guards Union. There's so much money. I say that there are five groups of people that are winning with regard to the war on drugs, and, you know, obviously in any program you have some winners and some losers. Now, the first group of people we've already talked about, those are the big-time drug dealers. They're making billions a year. The second group of people that are winning are the federal government and the local governments. The bureaucracies keep getting bigger and getting more and more money, and they, of course, continue to flourish, not because they're successful, but because they love to spend that money. The third group of people that's winning are the politicians that keep talking tough and acting tough with regard to the war on drugs. Not smart, just tough. They don't realize that every time we get tougher with regard to the war on drugs and prosecuting nonviolent drug offenders, we literally get softer with regard to the prosecution of everything else. That today, burglaries, for example, are not even investigated, much less prosecuted, because we're so busy spending time on these nonviolent drug offenses. The fourth group of people are the ones in private industry that build prisons or staff them, like what you're asking with your questions. That's a very large, lucrative market. They don't want to give it up, which is certainly understandable. People that sell burglar alarm equipment are doing a lot better because of increased crime, and so that's good for them, economically at least. And the fifth group of people we'd already talked about as well, and that's the terrorists of this world, and we simply must take away their source of funding. So it's an enormous problem. That isn't to castigate everybody that speaks up and says, no, we should continue with our drug war. It does mean, though, that there are powerful, powerful monetary interests for continuing with this failed and hopeless policy, and we have to recognize that.
I read on your website that, I forget the gentleman's name, but apparently an old colleague of yours gave a speech for the drug war and then left before your speech because he didn't want to have to debate you. And I think the article quoted you as saying, well, that's the most eloquent speech I've ever heard for the drug war. And that really goes to show just how far on the wrong side of this argument they are, if that's the best they can do. So I wonder, what was the most eloquent argument in favor of the war against drugs?
Well, actually, you paraphrase it pretty well. That, if I remember right, was Lee Brown at the time that he was the drug czar under President Clinton. And this took place at Harvard Law School. And he came in, gave a talk, and then simply left. No, he would not take questions. I actually went up to him and offered him half of my time if he would just come back and answer questions. And he looked at me like I was really screwy and said, oh, no, I have to leave, and then stayed downstairs for another half hour. You know, it's sad because, Philip, the people in our society that are pushing for the status quo are the drug czars, are the chiefs of police, even people in Congress. But it's really hard to get anybody to come and actually participate in the debate. The drug czar that took office after Lee Brown left was McCaffrey, General McCaffrey, and he was actually asked to come out to Orange County, here where I live, and speak at Chapman University. And I was asked as well to debate against him, and he originally accepted until, at least as I understand it, he found out it was a debate, and I said, oh, I don't have time to do a debate, but I do have time to give a speech. So he actually gave a speech but would not debate me, and then really didn't take many questions either. And I think that that's just really sad. I mean, those are the people that should stand up and say, look, we're doing the right thing for this, that, and the other reason, and take questions, but they don't do it. And, of course, under the circumstances, I'm not surprised, because all of the facts favor a change.
That's very interesting to me how there's such a shutout on public debate about this. You know, honestly, in preparing for this interview, I had to go back and think of all my good arguments against the war on drugs that, you know, I haven't even dusted off in years. I mean, this has been an open and shut case for me for so long. I'm amazed that anyone is still for the drug war, but then I look and like you say, you can't even have a debate about it.
Well, they look
at you like you're crazy when they're the ones who are crazy.
If we could just get one point across to our citizens, our taxpayers, and our voters, we would change away from this hopeless system. And that is that just because you discuss drug policy does not mean you condone drug use or abuse. And just because now you and I have been having this conversation for about half an hour does not at all mean that I don't think using drugs is a big deal or that I recommend it. In fact, it's just the opposite. I hate these drugs so much, I want to change our system so that we reduce the harms that can and will be caused by their presence in our communities. We couldn't do it any worse now if we were literally to sit down and try to come up with a program that would be worse. Now, we're taking it on the chin in every way imaginable, from a health standpoint, a civil liberty standpoint, the sale of drugs. The drugs are out there. We can't even keep them out of prison, for heaven's sake. How do you expect to keep them off the streets of Austin, Texas? So we couldn't do it any worse than we tried, but lots and lots of people are getting filthy rich and powerful by this, and that's the problem. So we need to make this a grassroots movement where the people stand up as one and say, no, We're not going to do this anymore. There has to be a better way. Let each state decide what is best for its people and reduce the role of the federal government, just like we did when we repealed alcohol prohibition, to simply assisting each state in enforcing its chosen laws. And then I assure you that we will come out with something an awful lot better. By the way, too, and I know we're running out of time a little bit, if any of your listeners have further questions, they can visit my website. You mentioned it a minute ago, but it's www.judgejimgrayforsenate.com. Gray is G-R-A-Y, and it's the number 4. So judgejimgrayforsenate.com. It's interactive. I really need people to communicate with our campaign, to let us know what your email address is so that we can send you information. And if you agree with the message, you forward it on to people that are around the country, and of course, particularly in California, recommending that they support Judge Jim Gray for U.S. Senate, and that they forward on to their friends and neighbors as well. Because then by doing that, get the honest messages out there, again, that is, don't vote for the lesser of two evils between the Republican and Democrat. They're not doing anything positive with regard to the war on drugs, much less talking about a $500 billion federal budget deficit every year. Now, things are out of control. Our country is off the track. But people can do something about this, and I'm giving them not only a viable choice, but a positive one. But I need people to take it to heart and to spread this word and get this stuff done.
And I got to say, it sure would be exciting to have a libertarian in the United States Senate. There's only one independent there now, and he's independent because he's further to the left than the Democrats. And I just think, you know, especially with it, you know, what, 51-49 or whatever it is in the Senate right now, you could really
it would be pretty hard for me to be partisan in the United States Senate because I'd be the only one there. But I would, if you're right on the merits, you got my vote. But I want to do the right thing for the right reason. I'm so concerned about the direction our country is taking. We need to bring back principled leadership. We need to reduce the size of the intrusion of government. One of the things I would do right away, too, in addition to getting the federal government out of the marijuana prohibition business and also repealing the excesses of the Patriot Act, would be to have an audit of every federal agency we have. And, for example, every 5 years we'd have a sunset provision. And every 5 years, every federal agency would simply be required to come to Congress, show what they've been doing, show what their plans are, justify their existence. And if they could do that, you know, we might pat them on the head and say, Philip, you've done a great job. We'll even increase your funding for all that matter. But
oh,
I
Judge
swear
Gray,
to
you better start wearing a bulletproof vest. You want to go around proposing laws like that.
Well, you know, there's no provision today for doing away with disbanding any federal agency. It almost can't be done under the law. But I swear that if sunset provision, just to have an audit, just to focus a light on each agency, we could reduce the size of government by about a third after that first five-year cycle without reducing its effectiveness, just its dead wood. And these are things that we all need to do. This government just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And, of course, then once you have a bureaucracy, you have to justify your existence, and they keep getting involved in all kinds of things. Now, one of them, you know, I believe in low-cost housing. I think we all do. Well, are you or your listeners aware that about 30% of the cost of a house, at least in California, is spent just trying to comply with government regulations? I mean, these are things that are simply not necessary, not productive, not working, but it's really good for the government bureaucracies, and that's why we keep it up.
I'm Philip Drew, and I'm interviewing Judge Jim Gray. He's running as a libertarian for the United States Senate in California. We still have almost another half hour here if you'd like to stay on, so if you have somewhere to go.
You know, you mentioned where you are in Austin. I feel like I'm almost back home there. I was in the Peace Corps, and I had my Peace Corps training in San Marcos, Texas, which isn't all that far from you. So at Southwest Texas State College, it was then called. I really enjoyed Texas and certainly the Texans as well. So I'm happy to talk with your folks.
Well, I'm honored to hear that from you, Your Honor. Let's see here. I read in your book that the UN is trying to criminalize opposition to drug laws. Now, that's kicking the drug war up a notch or two, I think.
You know, the whole history of drug prohibition is filled with additional, more radical efforts to make the square peg fit into the round hole. I mean, people in Washington, people around the world realize that it isn't working, and so they keep trying to do more and more radical things to make this failed system work. And, you know, it's anything from taking away your housing benefits, your school benefits, taking away your driver's license, all of these different things that bear no relationship to the actual offense of possessing drugs. But they know that they can't make progress by putting everybody in jail, so they try to do these very other crazy things. And it just puts us into an arbitrary position in government, and also a very harmful one. We actually had the United States Supreme Court on a case out of Oakland, California, rule that it was all right to kick two grandparents out of their federally assisted house when their grandson, whom they had taken in because he was having some trouble, was found to be smoking marijuana a block away, unbeknownst to them. And even the judge at the time said, you know, probably your crime is just loving your grandson too much and taking him in when you shouldn't have, and they actually kicked them out of federal housing. Well, you know, how is that any different than Jeb Bush, who is the governor of Florida, whose children, whose daughters were involved with drug problems? Maybe he should be kicked out of his government-assisted housing as well in the state house, because they were very likely abusing drugs in the state house. That isn't going to happen, but how is that any different than some poor soul in downtown Oakland or Austin or anywhere else? It just puts us into a position where the law is held up in disrepute. And as a judge, I do not believe in that. I hate to see it. I want to have reasonable laws, and then I want to enforce those laws. And today, what we're doing is flat out not working. So I am running for the U.S. Senate, as we said, and I request the support of your people. Everyone knows someone that lives and votes in California, and if you will send these messages on to them to support Judge Jim Gray for U.S. Senate, every vote I get will stand up and be counted. I may win this or I may not. It's a rather substantial undertaking. But, you know, if I just even make a good solid showing, that will be seen by the Democrats and the Republicans in future elections as the difference between winning and losing. They're going to want those votes. The only way they get those votes is to change their drug policy. And, of course, if they do that, then I will have won the election. So that is a motivating factor. You can't lose. We will make a strong showing. We're going to do something positive and really put our country back on the right track.
Sure sounds good so far, but, you know, if you want my support, and, of course, I live in Texas and can't vote for you, but I got to know where you stand on the war on terrorism. I read something on your website that said you want to internationalize the situation in Iraq and get America out of there as soon as possible, because the American mission in Iraq right now is a diversion from, quote, the legitimate war on terrorism. And so my question for you is, which war is that?
Well, I think that it's fair to say that the war, the fighting that we undertook in Afghanistan was a war against the terrorists. In effect, their government had given solace and peace and control and security to Osama bin Laden and all of those other folks that performed this act of war upon us. So I supported going into Afghanistan, and of course we made some promises there that now we're turning our back on, and we should not. If the United States of America gives people promises, that means we should keep them. With regard to Iraq, in my view, it doesn't really help should we have gone there in the first place, or whose fault is it, or pointing fingers, all of which is a waste of time and unhelpful. But it is clear to me, Philip, that the United States of America cannot effectively occupy a country like Iraq. Put it this way, how would you like, or anyone else there, to have the Iraqi army occupying Texas, even if they were there for originally legitimate purposes? You know, with the cultural differences, religious differences, and the language, certainly, and everything else, it would get real old real fast. So if it's going to be done, which it has to be now under these circumstances, it should be done by the world community. And we should do our part. We should do more than our part. The United States of America should stand by the June 30th date to hand over control back to the locals, and at least by Christmas, the United States of America as such should be out of there, and hopefully then the world community, with us doing our share, should take over.
Well, being a judge, I'm sure you're familiar with the Constitution, and Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11. Grants Congress the power to issue letters of marque and reprisal for dealing with basically pirates, groups of terrorists that are smaller than a state. And I think it's worthy to note that in Afghanistan we let Al-Qaeda go. There's a great article, if you haven't read it, by Cy Hirsch in The New Yorker called The Getaway, where we actually literally purposely helped Al-Qaeda escape while we were overthrowing the Taliban that didn't do it, and in fact had sent someone to come and warn us a few weeks before it happened that it was about to happen. And we let Al-Qaeda go because the United States Congress gave George Bush a blank check to do what he wanted. And so instead of going after the individuals responsible, he went over there and overthrew the government and let the guys who did it get away, and has now gone and taken, the war against terror basically means a war against any state that is a so-called rogue state that we don't like.
And well, Philip, you're getting over my head a little bit. I don't know these things. I do know, however, that we have definite limitations as to what we can do and cannot do, or what we should do or should not do. And the type of government that various countries should have is really up to them. It is not up to us. I certainly believe in human rights and human dignity all around the world to the extent that we can do it. However, we might lay a little more introspective here and look at our human rights and everything that we have in our country. I look at the Los Angeles County Jail and see that as the largest mental institution in the country. We have numbers of people there on nonviolent drug charges, for example, that are mentally ill, are very fragile folks, and we're harming them by putting them in custody. So these are human rights that we also need to look at. But life is complicated. There may be some good things and not. But I think we mean well. I think that we want to do the right thing. But under these circumstances, it is simply not possible for us effectively to occupy Iraq. It just is not working. It will not get any better. We have to turn it back to the locals as soon as possible, with the assistance of the rest of the world, instead of just having it basically be the United States of America. Otherwise, there are always conspiracy theories and the rest, and that's over my head. I don't know, and to some degree, I don't care. Anytime you're talking about big money, and by goodness, we're talking about big money here, there's certainly an all kinds of opportunity for fraud, deceit, conspiracy, and the rest. I say, for example, if we're concerned about our security, and I am, and we all are, we need to stop making so many enemies around the world. Just like I said, we'd conduct an audit of our federal agencies, I would also conduct an audit of the military presence of the United States around the world. But I stopped counting at about 120 different countries where the United States of America right this minute has a military presence. And not just embassies with a contingent of Marines, but an actual military presence. I'm not an isolationist. I think I've been in the Navy. I know how important military is. But let's conduct an audit and see if our presence in all of those countries is still helpful and appropriate for our security needs. And if we need to cut back, let's cut back and withdraw some. If we are harming our security interests or not helping them by being there, then let's withdraw those too. We are so overcommitted anyway with our military. A lot of places we're present, or they actually hate us for being there, and it's not furthering our purposes. Let's just look at it, scratch our heads together, and then do what's right for the United States of America.
I guess in terms of the war on terrorism, what I'm really trying to get out of you here is something to the effect that a war against Al-Qaeda is one thing. A war against terror, which just means fear and doesn't really mean anything, is really just a blank check for this imperial foreign policy, where if it was a war against Al-Qaeda, then we could kill some Al-Qaeda guys and then it would have an end instead of last multiple generations like Dick Cheney has promised us it's going to last.
Well, Philip, I think you're right in your focus, and certainly I don't have all the answers either. Let me try this on you. It seems to me that there's no world leader that would have done what we have done. No actual effective world leader, not Winston Churchill, not Abraham Lincoln, not Teddy Roosevelt, to, for example, color code our degree of panic for the day. But right now we're having an amber alert or a red alert or a yellow alert or whatever it is. No one effectively in leadership would have done this. Because, of course, we'll never get to green. They never have the courage to say, oh, there's no threat anymore. So this just perpetuates the panic. And what you do instead is you say, we were attacked, and this was an act of war, and we're going to find those people responsible, etc. But we're not going to change our lives. We're not going to destroy our civil liberties in order to save them. We're not going to change what we do. We're going to be our principled selves. We're going to overcome this because we are Americans. We're going to get through this, and we're going to survive it. And that way, in effect, you don't have the perpetuation of this hysteria. Now, it may be good for people in power and political power to be a wartime president or leader or whatever, but you're right. There is no war on terrorism, per se, in Iraq. It is clear, even Tony Blair in England said that there was no connection between Saddam Hussein and the terrorists, and Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda folks. If there are terrorists there now, and there probably are, it's because we have gone in there and we have attracted them. Osama bin Laden really wanted us to change our government. Well, he's successful. He really wanted us to start losing our civil liberties. Well, he's successful. And he wanted to show the world that this was, in fact, a fight between Christianity and Islam. And we have played into his hands by doing that as well. So that has resulted in the creation of numbers and numbers of other terrorists around the world because, rightly or wrongly, they see us being in Afghanistan either to get their oil or to have a Christianity war, another crusade, in effect, against the nation of Islam. It just is doomed to failure. It is something that we will not effectively be able to perpetuate. And the people that voted for it in Congress, I think, at least voted for the Patriot Act, and every senator voted for that except one, was an abrogation of responsibility by at least not looking at it first before they voted in favor of it. And these are things that we need to slow ourselves down, look at, be responsible, be reflective, and remember that the reason we're great is not because of our government, it's because of our principles, it's because of our people, because of their ingenuity to be able to get out there and perform and work out a better life for themselves, and not because we have a bigger and bigger, more intrusive government.
Now that's what I want to hear a senator say when I turn on C-SPAN.
Well, you're going to have your chance, Philip, if you and your listeners help get Judge Jim Gray elected to the U.S. Senate. Again, you know, I've been a judge for 20 years. I'm too old to change. This is who I am. This is what I'm going to do. I don't care who sponsors legislation. If it would work, if it's the right thing to do, you've got my vote. And if it isn't, I don't care if you're my next-door neighbor who I love completely. I'm not going to vote for it because it's not the right way to go. We need to bring principles back into our world. We need to bring people back there that want to do the right thing for the right reason, and that's the whole purpose for what I'm doing. I'd request your support.
And also, I noticed on your website you have some things to say about healthcare and education. On healthcare, you said you want the U.S. to have the cheapest prescription drugs in the world. And I thought, wow, that would be quite a reversal. How do you foresee that coming about?
Well, just to make the drugs as available at whatever price here as they are in England or Canada or New Guinea, as far as that's concerned. Unfortunately, we put barriers upon that and artificially inflate the prices, which is not good for our people. And that's done politically, and there's no reason for it. So, you know, as far as free trade, I believe in it. And by the way, it's very rare to have countries choose their customers, that if you are doing trade with a country, pretty much you're gonna have peace with them, and we have found that in the past and will continue. Our health care, our education, you raise extremely important questions, and I'm going to answer them this way. I was a child of our public schools and believe in them, and I think that I was well served by them. And around the mid-1960s, I think that the United States of America had some of the best public school systems in the world, and we were the envy of the world. But around that period of time, the federal government began more and more to get its tentacles involved in this, to control them by the federal money, etc. And now look where we are. I mean, they're a disaster, and it's because there's no local control, there's no local responsibility. That if I were a principal of a local high school, I would say, well, you know, it isn't my fault. All I'm doing is what the federal government orders me to do. And, of course, there's nobody in the federal government that is so colossal that nobody takes responsibility there either. So I say get the federal government out of this. Return control to parents, local boards of education, to the local group. And then if things work, they'll be perpetuated. If they don't work, we'll know exactly why. and will either change it around or put in people that will. So I say get the federal government out of this. Same thing with the healthcare industry that you raised. Around the mid-1960s, you never heard anybody talking about, oh, there are not enough emergency rooms in our neighborhood. Oh, there was never a discussion that I can't find quality health care for reasonable prices. It just wasn't a topic of discussion. But, again, around that period of time, the federal government began to get its tentacles involved in this entire operation, and now look at it. You have the federal government, the legislature, passing resolutions and laws saying, you as a doctor will do this, or you as an insurance company will cover that, or you can't cover this, or whatever else, and they made an absolute boggle of the whole thing. And I say get the federal government out of it, allow patients and doctors and insurance companies to negotiate and work out what is right, all the while, of course, and I'm an old Peace Corps volunteer, as I said, we have to have a safety net for our people, but make the government be the last resort, and then look at the folks that really can't afford this, really can't do it, and then you can set up something for them, and I'll be in the vanguard for it. But to bring to an end this discussion, listen to today. We have two areas in our medical healthcare field where people can get good quality medical attention for competitive prices. And if you think about it, one of them is LASIK surgery for your eyes, and the other is cosmetic surgery in various regards. Why? Because the federal government and insurance companies are not involved. And then you or I here on the radio or newspaper or whatever, these doctors advertising, they're competitive in their pricing, they're giving good quality care. Why? Because there's competition. And then you're getting good quality care for reasonable prices. We can reclaim that in the rest of society and then simply focus upon those folks like the mentally ill, the people that simply cannot take care of themselves. That number will be reduced because the cost of medical care will come down so much. Once we get the bureaucracy out of it, the fraud, the manipulation, that means the government. And then we'll reclaim what we had before. It's really not that hard.
Doesn't sound too hard to me. It's funny, isn't it, kind of sometimes about how the principles of liberty tend to always lead to the right pragmatic solution every time?
You know, I still don't quote Patrick Henry as saying, but as for me, give me more government or give me death. It just doesn't happen that way. Liberty is a wonderful thing. Free choice is a wonderful thing. People, if you were to go to medical savings accounts, for example, where if you're employed by a company, and they were just to give you an account for $5,000, all of the statistics show that the average for people is spending about $2,000 to $2,500 per year. That's an average. If you spend that, fine. The remaining balance simply is kicked over in your own personal account. In effect, goes into an IRA so that you have that for future issues. If eventually you retire, you can keep that money, or your estate can have that money. If you all of a sudden need kidney dialysis or something major, then you do have catastrophic insurance coverage that covers you. But otherwise, then, you, Philip, can go and negotiate with your doctor, see exactly what you want, figure out what it is, and take care of it and pay for it out of your account. That way you will have incentives to get exactly what you need for a reasonable price. The doctors will have the same, and they won't have to go through this boggle of all of these different policies and all of these different rules and regulations. They'll simply tell you what you're going to get, and you agree to it, and they get their money. We will then go back to spending money for doctors, for medicines, for hospitals, and get away from all of this fraud and bureaucracy and administration. Again, it's just not that hard if you simplify it. You don't want to be simplistic, but simplification is kind of the way to go. Just like federalization is not where you want to be, you want the concept of federalism. And those are two distinctions that we really need to focus on. Life should not be as complicated as we have made it, but unfortunately politicians love bureaucracy, and that's where we've been gone.
Well, I got a complicated one for you here. You brought up free trade in the discussion of prescription drugs there. And I wonder, does your support of free trade translate into support of NAFTA and the free trade area of the Americas, or do you see those as separate issues?
No, I see those as the same issues. Free trade is a good thing for everyone, and of course there are always problems. But let me put it this way. If we were in the framers of the Constitution, there was some talk that Virginia wanted to protect its markets from Massachusetts, for example, and they wanted trade barriers to keep Massachusetts products out of Virginia. Can you imagine what our country would be today if they had been successful? if you have a tariff on bringing things in from Oklahoma or out of Texas or whatever, everybody loses, except, of course, the bureaucrats.
And but is it wise to create supranational organizations in order to get rid of those barriers? I mean, I understand your analogy that the American Constitution was really the first NAFTA, but does the United States now, is that really in our interest to create organizations above and beyond our government that can dictate to us what our laws and tariffs and whatever are?
Not necessarily. I think all of these are our decisions to make. However, I believe that free trade is helpful to everyone, certainly including us. And in fact, if you go to your local men's shop or something, we consumers now, because of NAFTA and free trade, have so much higher quality of clothing for so reduced a price that it's just amazing. Gosh, I can go to good quality stores and buy a really good men's shirt, dress shirt, for $20 and frequently less. And it's good quality unheard of from before. And all of that is because of this. So the consumers are not organized. The people with regard to the other end are, and so they complain more, but the consumers are really being benefited by this, and it perpetuates. The United States of America, Philip, can compete with anybody on a level playing field. We are able to do that, and it helps the world to have free trade. And so I think that NAFTA has been successful in that regard. Yes, we have problems with regard to the exporting or outsourcing, they call it, of jobs. But you know something? That's inevitable. No matter what we put up in the way of barriers to that or artificial barriers to the market, people are going to get around them. And you know that as well as I do. So we have to realize this. That's part of the problems. But if we less encumber our businesses here, like I said, with regard to low-income housing, if you cut back all of these colossal amounts of red tape and bureaucracy and rules and regulations and let the free market take care of it, if you buy a house and it's not working, you can always sue the architect and the rest, but you don't need all of these regulations. The government is part of the problem. The government does not contribute well. They just get in the way and increase the bureaucracy. So that's what's happening with regard to trade as well. And if we would step back and allow our manufacturers to work without all of these barriers, we could then be able much more profitably to manufacture goods in the United States and continue to be more competitive.
You heard it. James P. Gray. He's a Superior Court judge in Orange County, California. He's running for the United States Senate as a Libertarian candidate. And I'd like to wish you best of luck, sir. Thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. And have your listeners visit my website, judgejimgrayforsenate.com, Gray, G-R-A-Y, and the number 4. I need their help. And it's been a pleasure talking to you, and good luck to us all.
Good thing. I hope to see you at the Libertarian Convention in a week or two.
I will be there. Take care and see you in Atlanta.
All right. Take it easy.